DeLaForest, Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 151 before the committee with recommendation to pass and be referred to the Environment and Natural Resource Committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I did have one author's amendment. It's coded DE2, and that would put the bill into the form in which I'd like to present it. And, Madam Chair, for you and the committee, all that amendment simply does is it adds the Wetlands Reserve Program to my bill. The good people at Ducks Unlimited had contacted me and suggested I do that. So, Madam Chair, if I could have someone be kind enough to move my DE2 amendment, please.
Representative Fels?
Yeah, I so move.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you for granting a hearing on this issue. I'm pleased to be joined today by Representative Hoche on what is obviously a nonpartisan issue, and that's the Conservation Reserve Program. As members of this committee well know, all of you being involved in agriculture in some way on this committee, how important this issue really is, and so we don't need to spend a lot of time talking about it. I'm happy to take questions. I would simply note that, of course, we do have scientific data now. I believe it was last August that the Department of Agriculture released a study that demonstrated empirically, scientifically, that CRP does contribute to larger pheasant populations, for example. So we do know that. Other than that, everyone on this committee knows that there's an increasing tension here given the rise in corn prices, primarily due to the explosion of corn-based ethanol. And so there are a lot of pressures on land that is in CRP regarding future enrollments. If I might, Madam Chair, I would just simply quote the Agriculture Secretary Johans, who noted, this is from the President's fiscal 08 budget. As CRP contracts expire in coming years, high commodity prices and other market forces within agriculture will likely provide incentives for producers to convert current CRP land into agricultural production. Growing demands for agricultural commodities globally and for use in production have increased the competition for land. And so, Madam Chair, that is why I contacted you and thought that this resolution was important. Here on the 20th anniversary of CRP, I think it's a critical program that's under increasing pressure. And so, again, I'm happy that that you granted a hearing. I'm very grateful for that. And I don't know if Representative Hoche wanted to make any comments.
Representative Hoche?
Madam Chair, and I don't know if somebody's made a motion to move this bill forward, but I would like to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. We have to make sure that we continue the CRP program and encourage future enrollments, especially as Representative DeLaForest commented on the future competition for land and the increasing values. But I want to also talk about the benefits that it brings to our rural economies and for development. It's important to note that this is an economic tool. For our young families and our families to be able to have lands, public lands, to be able to hunt on that are good prime habitat for our waterfowl is essential. And this is something in my district that I believe is strongly supported and would like to encourage the committee to pass this forward and to send a strong message to Congress that this program cannot end and that we have to continue to not only pursue this but also encourage future enrollments.
Thank you, Representative Hoche. Would you like to introduce your testifier?
Madam Chair, Joel Dugan for Pheasants Forever is here to testify on the bill.
Thank you. You'd state your name for the committee.
My name is Joe Dugan, and I'm with Pheasants Forever. I work out of the national office here in St. Paul, Minnesota, where Pheasants Forever was born. And I'm going to make a quick invitation. Next January 2008, Pheasants Forever will be celebrating its 25th anniversary. It's going to be right here at the St. Paul Energy Center, and I'd like to invite you all to come. It's going to be quite an event, and we're looking forward to celebrating our success. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Conservation Reserve Program, the products delivered by it to the land, to wildlife, to Minnesotans has been phenomenal, to say the least. Our name, Pheasants Forever, I'll represent our parochial interests, no, wildlife. Pheasant populations in Minnesota have more than tripled in the last several years. This past fall was the best pheasant hunting season in terms of bird harvest in about 30 or 40 years. That would not be possible without the Conservation Reserve Program. But the real measure of the success of the program is, in many respects, what it the things it does beyond what it does for wildlife. We have in Minnesota, you know, we're the father of waters here, but we've got a lot of major water problems. We have problems with soil erosion, water quality, all those kind of things. One of the phenomenal things that CRP has done here in Minnesota has buffered literally thousands of miles of streams and waterways, wetland areas. We have a problem up in, is it Annandale, Clearwater area, with a development now because of the what's happening down in Lake Pepin. And we are all connected by what happens on the land. And CRP is a tool that provides incentives to farmers and landowners to do some conservation on the land. That conservation probably would not happen without CRP. And for that matter, Wetlands Reserve Program in addition. This program is dollars that come to Minnesota from Congress. And these are federal dollars that we are getting a giant return on some of the tax dollars we send to Washington, D.C. for conservation. Many of you are aware of the interest in a dedicated funding stream for conservation here in Minnesota, for wildlife, for water, for other things. That investment, you know, we've heard numbers, you know, $100 million, $200 million. I don't know where it may end up. Hopefully it'll be in the higher realm. CRP dollars in Minnesota is over $100 million a year that comes to the state to pay for conservation. That's a tough order to fill. And if we lose that, we're going to lose a tremendous amount of conservation in Minnesota. There is no doubt that CRP can be adjusted, improved, refined. It has evolved since it was first passed in 1985. And I'm sure it will continue to evolve. But for Minnesota, who is one of the major recipients of the program in terms of other states across the country, we need to do what we possibly can to ensure it gets reauthorized and that the citizens of Minnesota can yield the results of the program or that farmers and landowners have some options that they can, when they're analyzing what to do with their land, they have some options that can steer them doing some toward doing effective conservation of the land. And without CRP, there is nothing that we have that would match it in terms of dollars and acres that's impacted. That's all I have.
Thank you. Are there any other testifiers?
Madam Chair, not that I know of.
Any other questions from the committee or comments? Representative Heidrichen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's always good. I'm very quite familiar with, and I think all of us out in rural Minnesota are quite familiar with the CRP program, the RIN program, and all the other programs that are available. But one thing within your testimony that I think was not brought out. The birds have come back. The pheasants have come back quite a bit, and I give the groups that are involved, the Pheasants Forever, among other groups,
thank you,
a lot of credit there, because there was a lot of hard work done there. Something that's very seldom brought up, and I wish that everybody could do it. Each year I go out, and we've got sustainable farmers, and we've got people that farm organically, and they use pastures. And wherever, I know last year, and I alluded to this once before in committee, we have a Dan Jenigas out there in between Representative Junkie's district and mine up in that area that runs a lot of pasture land. And wherever there's livestock on that particular pasture land that he's using that year, that's where the pheasants are. That's where the ducks are. And the lands that sit there for 5 years, we can go back, we walk those lands where they were not cropped at all by livestock, there weren't any birds. And when I remember when I was a kid, we used to go out and we had haul manure, and there would be 50 to 100 pheasants around that manure pile. I, for the first time this year, got permission within the city of Freeport to have manure hauled on my garden. I've got an acre garden in town, and it's the first year I've ever had pheasants in my backyard. But I mean, there's a close correlation as well. And I've been working with the Farmers Union up over here, getting a bill up where we've got the CRP land and RIM land, among others, that we could use those lands for limited cropping with the livestock. The CRP program is very good, but you got to remember, every time we put more land into it, Representative Hodge, we've taken land out that's paying a lot of taxes, whether it be corn land or whether it be soybean land or whatever it be. We have to be very, very careful. Some of the lands that we put into the CREP program, we had in Pope County, Chair Junkie, in Pope County, the last couple of years, in the CREP program, 100 miles away from the Minnesota River, entire farms put into the CREP program. That was not the intent of the program. I know of farms around my hometown that are good, valuable farms, good land, that can produce good agriculture and can produce and add to the economy of my small town. But you got to be careful of it. But I like the CRP program. I see how it works in Pope County. It works very well. I have problems with it coming in some of the areas in Stearns County where it's good, prime, you know, land that could be used elsewhere. Just an issue I thought I had to be brought up. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? If not, Representative Fels, do you want to renew your motion?
Yeah, I move that I renew my motion to House Bill 151 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to Environment and Natural Resources Committee.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
Your time.
Motion passes. Representative Hansen. Representative Eakin, would you like to move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll move House File 402 with recommendation to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee.
Welcome, Representative Hansen. Please Thanks. Explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If I could impose upon you to make a couple small author's changes, if someone could move these, just a couple words to get the bill into the form that I'd like it to. On line 1.9, between the words pesticide and the word in, insert the word for hire. Two words, for hire. And then on the next line, line 1.10, after the word consultation, strike of a and insert with, and then make representative plural.
Representative Eakin, would you like to move the amendment?
So move.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Just before I start on House File 402, for some members of the committee, they may not know that prior to coming to the legislature, I worked at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I was a supervisor in the pesticide applicator licensing program. So this was the area licensing people who apply pesticides for hire was the area that I worked in for many years. And one of the challenges we struggled with was, how do we make sure that folks are being trained properly, getting a minimum level of competence, and assuring the consumer and the that the environment that they apply pesticides for hire in is done properly. Currently, Minnesota law says anyone applying a pesticide for hire needs to be licensed. So if Representative Junkie was applying an agricultural pesticide for hire, he'd have to be commercially licensed. If Representative Eakin was applying a turf application, he would have to be commercially licensed. What House File 402 does is it directs the Department of Agriculture to work with the Department of Health to develop a category of license, just like the other types of categories of license, for those persons who are applying antimicrobial pesticides for hire in homes for mold remediation. I'm not talking about a maid service coming in who might use an antimicrobial soap. I'm talking about folks who are advertising and their business is coming in and spraying pesticide for mold or fungal remediation. And I have a couple of folks who are constituents in the district next to mine who I've worked with on some of these mold issues who are going to talk a little bit about their experience with in this. And then I believe the Department of Agriculture and the university may have some comments as well. But the intent of 402 is to bring those same folks that are applying, same type of person who's applying a pesticide for hire for antimicrobial, it's an implementation study to have the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, and the university work together to develop the materials and the need necessary report back to us on how to bring this type of application into compliance with existing law. When you go through the subdivisions, it talks about looking at existing federal and state laws. In Minnesota, we give authority to the Commissioner of Agriculture to develop categories of licenses. Some states, they direct that in statute. I believe that we can have the Ag Department, the Health Department, and the university work on this, look at what's going on in other states, look at their experience, look at the literature that's out there, and report back to us on how to bring these folks into the same type of regulation that other applicators in the state have. And with that, I'd take some questions, or I can have the testifiers come forward.
Are there any questions or comments to Representative Hansen? If not, you can call your test. Oh, excuse me. Representative Pulse. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify and make sure that I understand this. If this is asking the Department of Agriculture to come up with guidelines for this type of license. It's not saying we're going to have this type of license or that they have to do it. It's just suggesting or asking them or forcing them to come up with guidelines as to whether or not we even should have such a thing. Is that correct?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Faust, this is, I use the word implementation study, to study the development and implementation, because I believe under current law, this type of license needs to be covered currently under current law. This is a new area. This is a different audience and a different industry. And so they're to study the development and implementation and report back to us on how to do it. But my intent is for them to do it with us providing some advice next year.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? If not, could you introduce your testifiers?
Thank you. This is Nancy Johnson. And Nancy, do you want to give a little background?
My name is Nancy Johnson, and I'm a homeowner, and I've been working with a homeowner's advocacy group for the last several years. But my talk here this morning, or my story, is about our situation in our home. My husband and I had our house reshingled. Some of you have heard this. We had our house reshingled. The roof wasn't covered properly. It rained for hours and hours, and we had water coming in all our windows and doors Sunday morning. So we called the roofing company and talked with them and decided to start looking to get somebody in to dry out our house, thinking we could do that. Went to the Yellow Pages and found a company, a national company, that if I told you the name, you would recognize it immediately. They sell franchises, so they have little companies all over Minnesota. So on Monday, I asked them when they could be out at our house, and they said, well, Tuesday afternoon. So Tuesday afternoon, and in the meantime, we're trying to contact the insurance agents to work with them. So Tuesday afternoon they came out. Two people came out at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and they started bringing these big fans in, started cutting holes in our wall. And when I was on the phone with some other folks, I you know, they continued to work, but one of the gentlemen brought in a spray and started spraying this product around our living room and around the walls and downstairs. And I asked him what it was, and he said, well, it's a spray to stop the fungus and the mold. Now, this was on Tuesday, and it had been raining for 4 hours on Sunday in our house. And so I said, well, you know, what is in it? And he rattled off something that I had no clue what was going on. And anyway, when I called that company on Monday and asked them how much it would be to do this procedure in our house, they told me approximately $1,500. Well, so one person was there pretty much for 2 hours. Another one was off looking for some more fans. They left 2 hours later. Before he left, he gave me a bill, and it was for $4,000. And I said, you told us it was going to be about $1,500. And he said, well, it went up, and it's this and that. And I said, well, I said, that wasn't the price we agreed on. And he said, well, you have to pay that. And I said, well, what will happen if I don't? And he said, well, we're going to take all the fans. Now, imagine our whole house is entirely soaking wet because of all the windows and doors and insulation. And so I wrote him out a check. And then the next day, I stopped payment on the check. And so that was kind of ugly, but our insurance company helped us deal with that. And finally, it was settled for $1,500. He gave me no information about anything that was applied. And truth be told, this happened Sunday, the rainstorm. And by Tuesday, it was probably too late for him to do anything, but he didn't know what he was doing. And we ended up a couple months later basically gutting out our entire house. We finally hired an engineer that we actually got through the Department of Health. They maintain a list of people in this field, and we had a professional engineer that started to work with us on the process. But it was pretty scary because he was sitting there spraying this stuff all over the house, and you know, when you've never been through this before and you have a horrible problem, you can't shut your doors, your windows don't close, and everything's wet, you think, oh, well, they ought to know. They advertise in the Yellow Pages, they have, you know, they say this, they belong to this, and that. So I am really supportive of this type of bill because I think this happens to a lot of homeowners, and especially when you end up with not just a roofing problem with torrential rainstorms, which we seem to get occasionally here. So,
thank you.
If I could just follow up, that one of the things that we try to teach in pest management, whether it's agriculture or turf, is to identify the pest and try to determine the correct course of action and determine whether you need to use the product, making sure you have proper identification and then following through. So when you look at the licensing requirement, it's not just the application of a pesticide. It's identifying the pest, determining whether you need to use it, and then following through. And so in looking at this, we're looking at pest management and trying to make sure that the folks who are buying these pesticides for hire are properly trained, they can identify pests, they can make sure they have competence, and that we can be assured that they have the experience that they need to do this properly. Nancy Emerson also has a few words to say. Nancy, we have two Nancys here. So.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is Nancy Emerson. I'm also spent a couple years with the Homeowners Advocacy Group, but I was here today to tell my personal story. I've had a mold problem. I've had recently it's not been resolved, and I'm recently in chemotherapy for cancer. And as the Minnesota Department of Health clearly states, I'm one of those people at risk. And having been part of that advocacy group, I became aware of all the different kinds of things out there for mold remediation, which is what I've had to do myself in order to minimize my exposure to it. And you can go anywhere. You can go to home shows. You can look in the Yellow Pages. You can go to community classes on it. And they all have a different version of what they should do. And I think that that it's very imperative that, you know, I've gotten a lot of misinformation, and I am currently, again, with the Department of Health, a recommendation from the Department of Health, as certified engineer in antimicrobials is helping me remediate my house in the proper way, but there's a ton of misinformation out there, and the average homeowner doesn't know the difference, especially if they're not involved in construction issues, but they found out they've had mold. Like, you go to Home Depot, and you can get a mold test and find out if, you know, the black stuff on your wall's mold. They're going to call in the Yellow Pages, and they need someone that's very, very competent, that knows what they're talking about. They identify the source and do the proper remediation. Because if you don't do the proper remediation, it's worse. It can actually be worse than doing nothing at all. For instance, it's been clearly shown that the air cleaners that contain ozone exacerbate the problems. They don't mitigate it. And so I have air cleaners that don't have ozone, but they're advertised as stopping mold. So I really think this is a very, very, very important bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Emerson. Representative Finstead?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was for Nancy number one. It'll be a quick question, so I apologize for getting you back up here, but my question is, and maybe I didn't catch this, but what was the chemical used? Did you ever find that out?
I don't know. We didn't get any information at all. It could have been water, for as much as I knew. And you have to remember that. And if I knew then what I knew now, I wouldn't even call this company. But I think a lot of people do, because they take care of water damage issues.
Representative Finstead?
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And everything back to normal? The house is okay? Good. Good. Representative Hansen, sorry. There's so many of you. No. Give me the background. I do know this, that you worked for the Department of Ag, so I know your background a little bit. Tell me what the USDA, FDA labeling requirements are for some of these chemicals that would be used in that scenario. But then also, what's out there as far as the regulation goes right now, if applicators found guilty of misusing the chemical due to label requirements, what happens?
Thank you, Representative Finstead, Madam Chair. Just to back up a little bit, to maybe follow up on Nancy number one's comment, is that if you are a commercial applicator, then you have to provide a copy of the record of the application, if you're in agriculture, or if you're in lawn care, or structural. So part of her question or concern, if these folks were under the umbrella, which I believe they currently should be, she would need to get a copy of the record of what was applied and the amount, and by the applicator, if they were a commercial applicator. Federally, pesticide law is administered by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and it delegates authority to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture is the lead authority for enforcement of pesticide laws, whether they are the label, and the label on your container, whether if you go to a hardware store and pick up a container of weed killer and it has that label on it, the label is the law. And so you have to follow that label. The label on the pesticide that's an antimicrobial is also the law. So if they apply that improperly, there would be a violation there that the Department of Agriculture could enforce. However, when you have a competency measurement, whether if you're a farmer and you take the private pesticide applicator, you are demonstrating that you've got a higher level of competency. You're taking a test that you know what you're doing. If you're a commercial applicator, you're demonstrating a higher level of competency, and you're also required to go to continuing education training. So you have to pass a closed book exam, go to continuing education, provide proof of insurance to handle problems, and go through that annual licensing process. So there's a greater opportunity for enforcement and making sure that those competency measurements are handled when you are a commercial applicator, because you're doing it for hire versus doing it yourself. Ms. Johnson or Ms. Emerson, they could go to the hardware store, buy that, and do that themselves, but they're taking the responsibility when they do that themselves to follow the label. The difference is when you're coming in and you're doing it for hire, for compensation, you're assuming a greater degree of responsibility. And what this bill does is it helps develop that structure of having the competency measurement for this particular type of application.
Representative Binstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for those comments. I probably one of the few on this table that has a custom applicator license. So I understood.
Mailed it to you at one time.
Yeah, so I understood. Yeah, probably. So I understood that portion. I guess I didn't understand the commercial application of the mold, whatever we're going to call it, microbial or whatever. So simple question then. So if they come in now without the licensure and they put 5 gallons per square feet in their house, which is clearly over what the label would say, they're breaking the law, though, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. If that label is less and they apply more and they're not applying to label rates, the applicator is breaking the law.
Representative Hansen.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. This will be, I think, it.
That's okay.
So I guess the question comes down to, I mean, if it's already legal, what they're doing and what they're not doing, what, and I don't know if you're trying to address the legalities of it. What you're trying to do is clean up the industry, maybe, so to speak. I know that there's hard luck cases out there. I know there's bad actors. But I guess the question is, if it's illegal, it's illegal, and the department should be enforcing it or not enforcing it. I would assume that and I apologize for doing this, but Nancy number one's case, she could have called the Department of Ag, and they could have then followed up and enforced the law. So I don't know if, I guess my opinion, this is where my opinion will come in, I don't know if, you know, licensing these folks is just going to clean up the situation. I think you're going to have bad actors with license or without. So I guess I would you need to sell me more on it, I think.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Hinsett, there obviously always are bad actors. But there are some people that you can reach through education and training and have them bring into compliance. It also provides something for the consumer. I mean, that either of the Nancys could have asked for a copy of the license. I mean, when you have that license there, and whether you're applying lawn care or whether you're applying agricultural chemicals, you can ask to see that license to prove that the person's got the met the competency measurement. So we want to make sure that we've got people trained. And we want to make sure that, and that's where the whole certification and training came from, is let's, rather than banning a product or saying that people can't use that, let's make sure that we've got a regimen of training and licensing so that they can assure competence. I believe, having worked in this, that for many years, that current Minnesota law says, if you're applying any pesticide for hire, you should be licensed. But there is not a category and there's not a system for this type of application. And what I'm doing here with this bill is trying to help clean up the law and give some ability for the Department of Ag, the Department of Health, and the university work together to then develop the program, which I believe is already there, authorized in law, so that they can help the consumers and make sure that there's competency there for the applicators who are doing this application.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, the cost of the study, I was wondering if you had an estimate on that, or also who is going to bear the cost of it, Department of Health, Department of Agriculture, both of them?
I think the Department of Ag is ready here to maybe provide some comments on that.
Madam Chair. That was my next question, is what would someone from the department speak to it?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Greg Bezik. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Thank you for testifying.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we haven't done a fiscal note on this. We have talked with Representative Hansen. Antimicrobial regulation at the federal level is very complex. All we have to do is look at Hurricane Katrina and some of the aftermath there. Technically, it's a very difficult issue. So what we want to do in trying to describe the scope of this is make sure that it is a focused scope towards the implementation and development of a category and how to proceed with that. So we'd be looking at a minimal study, I guess, is what we're looking at right now. Nationally, it's such a huge issue, all of antimicrobials, that it would be very difficult and very expensive to deal with. EPA is dealing with that, as I said, at the national level. So we'd be looking at this, as Representative Hansen's explained to us, in a very limited sense. I can't give you an exact dollar amount right now, though.
Representative Hosh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Representative Hansen, a couple questions. One, has there been a disproportionate amount of complaints to the Attorney General's office or for consumer complaints in regards to this?
Representative Hansen?
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh, not to my knowledge. I have not asked the Attorney General's office for those type of complaints. I do know that there are, there's a number of issues relating to mold and mold remediation. What I'm trying to do here is to focus just on that part where you're having folks treat that. And I'm going off of just my anecdotal experience working in the agency, where I would take calls from people who had questions. We also did, commercial industrial buildings have mold issues as well. So we're trying to keep that relatively focused, but I have not checked with the Attorney General's office.
Representative Posh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, one more question, and just to try to get what your intention is for this study. Currently, a lot of people, I'm sure, that do mold remediation are already licensed as a residential building or remodeling contractor. Would you anticipate that there'd be overlap with the potential licenses, or that already those who are residential building contractors that are required to take 2 hours every single year in continuing education on the energy code, which most often deals with mold, would that be sufficient, or would this be another license requirement for a lot of our professionals?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh, the key with pesticide application is if they're applying a pesticide. So if you're doing a tear out or a clean out and you're not applying a product, you're not required to have the license. So if they're doing building construction or destruction or remodeling and there's not that application, then they would not need to be covered under this. However, if they are applying something in that process that's an antimicrobial, then they would need to be licensed. And part of what we have done in the past is if there's always a multitude of licensing issues. I would use the best example as maybe the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, where they have a convention where they do training where the Department of Agriculture, I was going to use we, but the Department of Agriculture would try to make it as simple as possible to have the training joint or to approve other training. If there was, the department has the authority to approve other training programs. So if that program has something on that, the department could approve that.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this will be my last question. So then, in the circumstance that I laid out, so it would not only be the Department of Labor and Industry involved in the residential contracting license process, but also then the Department of Agriculture?
Representative Chair,
the pesticide license applies to the person rather than to the company or to that business. So that's the person. It's a competency measurement of the individual.
Representative Hosh.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. So every employee or person would then have to be licensed, and it couldn't be one license, that would be an umbrella?
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh, if the person is applying a pesticide for hire, they would need to be licensed.
Any other questions? Comments? Do you have any other testifiers?
I think they're okay. Shaking their heads no. Yeah.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson.
Ms.
I'm sorry to take more time, but I just, based on a couple of the questions that were being asked,
Ms. Johnson, I just want to put your name on the tape, so
Nancy Johnson.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to read an email. Our homeowners groups, we have a number of engineers and building specialists and a lot of homeowners on our email list. But one of our engineers, Paul Elringer from Air Tamarack, sent an email about this issue. And he also sent comments to Representative Hansen, but he said, I would agree that this industry needs some type of regulation. I routinely see homeowners that get gouged with these products which have limited or no value. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture has regulations on who can apply an EPA-licensed product, and then in parentheses, few of these products are licensed by the EPA. Many of these products use chemicals that have some type of EPA approval, but not the manner in which the product is being used. And he also goes on to say that this gets very complicated, but the bottom line is there are vertically no regulations of these products. And Mr. Elringer probably has investigated up to 500 homes over the last probably 8 years with his business. And so I thought his testimony was worth reading.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, in conclusion, I have asked for a fiscal note. Representative Erdahl, I plan on working with the university and the Department of Health and Agriculture on this as it moves to the Finance Committee. I think it's an important bill that can help assure competence for folks that are doing these applications, bringing them into the same playing field that other applicators are. So I'd ask for your support, and again, if you have any questions, please let me know.
Anybody else have any questions, comments? If not, Representative Eakin, would you renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion that House File 402 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The bill passed.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson, welcome.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 589 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Bioscience and Emerging Technology Committee.
Thank you. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the interest of the schedule, I think there's a lot of witnesses or testifiers who want to get their word in here today, and I'll be relatively brief with an overview describing the bill. The way I see the bill, this House File 589, a DE2 amendment. You all have that?
Mm.
And there's a couple of handouts coming around. It should say House File 589 DE2 from 11:45 this morning.
Representative Eakin, do you want to move the amendment?
Yes, I'll move the DE2 amendment.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay. Now, thank you very much for that administration. I see the bill as having primarily four public benefits, one being local ownership of the next generation biofuel and bioenergy facilities. And I believe that the United States, this country, needs a clean, renewable American fuel and energy. Three, water quality will improve on working lands not well suited for traditional row cropping. And four, quality wildlife habitat established on working lands, increasing the breeding, if you will, the feeding, cover for wildlife and the recreational opportunities that are incumbent upon that behavior. What does the bill do? Since we're in environment policy, ag policy, I'll focus on a couple of specifics later, but what will the bill do? To work with farmers
to plant and establish perennial fuel crops, the next generation energy crops for Minnesota. I believe it will also enable working with the existing ethanol facilities and power producers to utilize biomass as an energy source through the gasification or direct burn, which is ready to go today. A couple plants are doing that or hope to be doing that more formally, depending on their permits they may or may not be getting from an agency that can't keep up to their development. But that's for a different bill. Other incentives in bill to work with next generation of cellulosic biofuel producers, ethanol or other liquid fuels. And I guess I've heard throughout the session is that picking the technology is not something we should do. I don't believe we are picking the technology in this bill. We're establishing the incentives for what the market wants to go towards for next generation biofuels. Now, important to note is that cellulosic biofuels are going to happen, or it's going to happen because of a federal standard of 250 million gallons of annual cellulosic biofuels by 2013, which was written into the 2006 Federal Energy Policy Act in D.C., the Congress. So we're establishing this in Minnesota as a plan, and I don't believe we should be cautious. I think we should be aggressive in getting that amount of gallons to land here in rural Minnesota. This bill provides funding for the research, technical assistance, monitoring, air permitting, which I mentioned, the nuts and bolts basically of the rollout through our state agencies, academic research, Bowser, DNR, MPCA, etc. But importantly, in this bill, the people who will qualify for the bill's incentives will have strong local ownership, participation, and control. Now, I'd like to compliment the chairs, Representative Chair Junkie and Chair Otremba, about the letter that they sent to Chair of the Ag Committee, Colin Peterson, related to some of the things I just stated. So you'll have all that in your packet as was just handed out. I want that included for the public record, if you will. Let's go to Section 4. I'll just do this briefly, and then we'll get into testifiers, since this is the policy part that this committee is probably most interested in. Just quickly, reinvest in Minnesota Clean Energy, our RIM-CE. So, proposing to establish a new working lands program where additional RIM easements are associated with lands near bioenergy conversion projects that will grow native perennial cellulosic crops for energy conversion. Establish a technical committee to develop these RIM CE standards that incorporate the public benefits, like the water quality, things I mentioned earlier, carbon storage, chemical inputs, such and such, and also equipment loans, for capital equipment loans. Establish a revolving loan fund for those in and outside the RIM clean energy program that use native perennial cropping systems for energy and seed production. It does allow the blending of feedstocks. We're not just saying that that's not something that's valid. And similar to ideas in the federal system being proposed, authorized but maybe not appropriated to the desire of some people, is a conservation security program style payment. So you've got tiers, tier one, tier two, tier three. Tier one would be one or more native perennials or plant species adapted to site conditions. So this could be the switchgrass plus one more maybe, which might be best suited for the sugar platform or the enzyme side of actual cellulose ethanol fuel. Tier two, you could have diverse native prairie or a mixture of at least 16 species and seasonal harvest restrictions to protect the nesting of birds on our lands, determined by the technical committee, not me, and overwinter cover retention. And going into tier three, you'd have those two tiers benefits plus reestablishment of seasonal wetlands, if you will, on those marginal lands that might be a little bit hard to farm and be consistent with yield, and a minimum size of 40 acres. So you're really getting into a significant, at least section by section basis, as you could tell in rural Minnesota, significant size, about 40 acres minimum. So that's just the section. You can, I suppose you could talk about any section you want, but I think that's the policy section. And with me today we have Diane Jensen from the Minnesota Project, who will start out, followed by Don Aronofsky, so with Clean Energy Minnesota. So we'll go from there. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, I know this is a policy committee, but since I'm not on the agriculture finance, I'd like to go to a finance question. In Section 7, by June 30th, 2008, the Commissioner of Finance shall transfer $3 million from the General Fund to the Renewable Energy Capital Equipment Revolving Fund. That $3 million kind of rings a bell. Are you intending the money as it goes offline, as the plants go offline, the ethanol? Is that the intent, to capture that money?
That part is. No.
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair and Representative Riddle, not in that part, but Madam Chair and Representative Riddle, yeah, the desire of the bill with input from other committees as we move through here, as you see, we're going to go to the Bioemerging Technology Committee next. As we get to the Finance Committee, I'm hoping for assistance from those chairs and members of those committees as to what the recommendation is, to keep that line in the budget that's currently, you know, going off for corn ethanol payments, and to not lose that authority, if you will, and appropriation through the MDA for something other than corn-based ethanol payments.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, as I recall, we have enabled legislation in the past that would keep that money in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
It's just we have not identified where it should be spent in the agriculture field. And so you are saying that this is a possibility as we go down the line with that.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, yeah, this is a possibility and a recommendation which many, many members and committees will have input on.
Okay, thank you.
So with that, Madam Chair, we'll turn it over.
Representative Heigerthen.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question and a comment. On page 6, section 4, line 6.19, and I have a problem with, you had mentioned earlier that the lands that would be sought for this would be highly erodible lands. We already have many, many government programs with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, with RIM, with CRP, with many, many, many other lands. But it says, not currently set aside, enrolled, or diverted under another federal or state government program, under eligible lands I'm talking about. I would think that those lands would be the... Oh, we're in the first. I'm in the wrong bill. Sorry.
Yeah, I thought so.
But
thank you.
I'll go back to one other comment.
Representative,
sure. All right. Thank you. I was wondering about eligible lands, and again, I thought, here we go again. But in one of the handouts we got right over here, this handout I'm referred to, there was mention of an issue that that Commissioner Hugeson brought up here last week, I think, in Representative Junkie's committee, where he has stated within 2 years that we will have the demand and supply will be there. It will be that the ethanol plants will be producing all of the ethanol that we need with the new plants that are going forth. And again, that will become an issue with this, obviously. And if we get to that point, is that going to have a dramatic effect here?
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, and that point being, what again? Are you talking about the language that says not to be currently set aside, enrolled, or diverted under another state or federal government program? Is that where you are? Are you under that handout there? But you can't be in two programs for the same.
No, I realize
you
that.
Can't
I
be in two. So we'd have to change federal eligibility. I mean, you just can't go out onto your CRP and cut it down and make a bunch of sell ethanol.
No. I'm referring back to, Madam Chair, sorry about that, Clean Air Energy Minnesota, biofuel basics. It says, currently transportation, this is the nation's vast appetite for liquid fuels. It goes on, currently transportation fuels are almost exclusively derived from oil. Yet, biofuels are a growing share of the market. The United States now has the capacity to produce 5.5 billion gallons of ethanol per year, with an additional 6 billion gallons pre-year under construction or planned, and that's where the commissioner had said that would basically, the supply would be meeting the demand. Okay, if we're at that point of where we're peaked out in ethanol, how dramatic of an effect will that have on this particular plant?
Representative Peterson?
Chairman O'Tremba and Representative Hagerkin, are you, I'm assuming that you're talking about corn ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that would supply the Minnesota market? Is that what you're referring to?
My point is, Madam Chair, my point being that if the supply is meeting demand, if we're making all the ethanol and it's being done quite cheaply with corn,
okay,
I realize that this is going to be far more expensive whether we go to mixed grasses, switch grass, whatever you want to use, a wood pulp, it's going to be far more expensive, at least in the near future. But if corn is already meeting the demand, this is going to be very, very, it's going to take away the interest in this area, I would think, if there aren't any new markets out there. Because ethanol, corn ethanol at the present stage is getting each and every year more efficient. And I think these other grass, everything else is far, far away yet, and it's going to take us a lot of money to get there. But with the supply meets the demand, I would think that interest in any of the new programs would be put on a back burner.
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hagerkin. I don't know if you were at the committee when we had the members from the various universities testifying, specifically California Berkeley and Governor Schwarzenegger, developing what you might call a low-carbon fuel that is produced by using different methodologies and inputs. And, for instance, if you make corn ethanol with fueling it with coal, you don't reduce any emissions. If you make corn ethanol fueling it with natural gas, you get a 20% emissions reduction. If you make corn ethanol using syngas or biogas, you get a 50% reduction in your emissions footprint. And if you're actually making cellulose ethanol, you're getting an 80% emissions reduction on your inputs and your outputs. And you could even claim, and the University of Minnesota would claim, that you're carbon negative. Therefore, I would see the development, and California is working on already, the price premium for that type of fuel that is made with low carbon emissions. And I think this would be a particular interest in California, where they have, you know, we don't need to go into the size and scale and scope of California, but I think you know what I mean. That could be an exportable product, you know, pulling up to a station that says low carbon fuel. So I don't think we necessarily should shut down any development of this, nor corn ethanol for that matter, but we should realize that there's gallons to be had in the federal energy bill that was passed, and there's a lot of desire, at least in the letter from the chairs that I read, to go down this path and not do it, you know, because corn ethanol is strong, and Senator Bickerman has made strong statements about his support of you know, non-corn ethanol, but I don't think we're shutting down corn ethanol anytime soon. But the diversity and the biomass gasification is occurring at Benson. And they'd like to choose their feedstock through testing and applied research. And they're moving ahead. What we need is an agency that can keep up with the technology. And, you know, I think that maybe demand might be satisfied in this statement here, or you might be satisfied with this, but I would think that there's a dynamic market and desire for emissions reductions, and not just from coal-fired power plants, but from those who drive their cars every single day, too. So that's my statement, and thank you for being generous with your time.
You're welcome. Would you want to introduce your testifiers or have them?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, excuse me. My name is Diane Jensen. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Project. The Minnesota Project is dedicated to rural economic development that also benefits rural communities and the environment. Our work centers on renewable energy and conservation, the promotion of local foods in Minnesota, and farm policy and practice that is profitable and also protects the environment. The Minnesota Project is a member of Clean Energy Minnesota. biggest reasons why I am here today, and perhaps we are here today, are national security, economic security, and environmental security. These are driven by oil and by global warming. Broadly, we know that we need to address fundamental energy problems. Dependence upon oil, foreign oil. The U.S. cannot drill its way out. Despite first 30 years of effort, we are more dependent on foreign oil. The cost of oil imports exceeded the value of U.S. agricultural production in 2006. We also know that Minnesota has no petroleum or fossil energy resources. So we need to go in other directions to solve our problems. Global warming. Oil accounts for 40% of the CO2 and energy used in the U.S. economy. So we need to do something about oil. There are two strategies that are required. One we are dealing with today. They are much more efficient vehicles and biofuels to replace oil. We need to do them both. On biofuels, agriculture has a major role in solving these problems for America. Corn ethanol is the foundation, but we need much more biofuels. We need cellulose. Minnesota and its productive farmlands are key in supplying the volumes required. We also see this as a huge opportunity for rural development, the likes of which we have not seen in a long, long time. The 25 by 25 economic model shows Minnesota ethanol production potentially reaching 4.5 billion gallons with cellulosic technology. And we need to note that the energy market is a market that exceeds any other ag market. It has been said that our hunger, our market for energy is insatiable. We need to see that it goes in the right direction. We also see that energy crops present an enormous opportunity to drive significant conservation gains on working lands, benefiting water quality, mitigating flooding issues, and creating wildlife habitat by creating opportunities for perennial crops on productive lands on a large scale. The Clean Energy Minnesota Biofuels Bill is a strategic integrated policy framework aimed at moving us forward. Minnesota's public policies need to realize and capture this renewable energy opportunity. We seek to build on national momentum for cellulosic ethanol and create the foundation for Minnesota farmers and entrepreneurs to engage and profit. We know there are barriers to farmers to plant new crops and to industry to adopt new technology. On the biomass side, supply side, we can modify a proven mechanism, conservation easements, to take away much of the risk and challenge associated with new cropping systems. We can also tune the payment structure to reward plantings that provide the greatest public benefits, but still have the flexibility to ensure that the products being produced are consistent with what the market requires. On the biomass demand side, we know that full-blown cellulosic ethanol plants are just at the cusp of commercialization. We are waiting for national demonstration projects to come online. We want to be prepared to ensure that Minnesota participates in the development of this new industry. But we also need to understand that there is a need to be mindful that the large-scale approach being taken by U.S. DOE is a risky strategy. We saw the difficulty of trying to bring closed-loop biomass power plants online in Minnesota. We need intermediate strategies that grow the biomass supply chain. Vinod Khosla, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist that is betting so heavily on cellulosic ethanol, notes that the energy transition to biofuels will require a number of intermediate steps, all of which have to be profitable. Using biomass to power existing corn ethanol plants and other ag processing facilities represents a key intermediate step. The high price of natural gas allows biomass to compete now, if we can remove key barriers and risks for plants. Minnesota can lead the nation with low-carbon ethanol in the near term. Our bill supports that. We have room for working with agriculture and plants starting where we are right now. Our bill prioritizes and incents native perennial energy crops, but also has the ability to take in existing biomass resources, be it crop residue or ag processing residue. Ultimately, we are looking at building a ladder that helps Minnesota and Minnesota farmers reach a high level of performance in terms of supplying abundant and stable sources of renewable fuels. But this ladder also includes the first rungs, the lowest rungs on the ladder, that will allow us to start from where we are today to reach higher goals in the future. Thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. Any questions? Representative Phelps, do you have a question?
I'll ask mine later.
Okay, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, in Section 3, it refers to the board quite a few times through Section 3. I was just wondering what board is it referring to? What's the makeup of that board?
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, Bowser Board.
Bowser. Right. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, state your name for the committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Arnosti. I'm a program director at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm here today also representing Clean Energy Minnesota, which is a coalition of 13 organizations whose names you can find at the bottom of the sheet that you have. These organizations have 450,000 Minnesotans as members, and those are individual members. The lists have been cross-compared, so that's approximately 10% of the people in the state belong to one of these 13 organizations. We thank you very much for your time and attention on this important matter. I'm not going to take a lot of time because you've had both the presentation of Representative Peterson and Diane Jensen, and I do want to make sure that there's enough time for the other folks who've traveled a longer distance to talk with you. But we feel it is a very important juncture, really a unique time that we have at this point. As some of the previous speakers have pointed out, our country has made a decision that we need to differentiate and expand the sources of energy that we have in the future. Large investments are going to be made, and much like Minnesota stepped forward about a dozen years ago and led the way nationally in the generation and the development of the first renewable fuel industry in this country, corn ethanol, we're encouraging and proposing with this bill that Minnesota step forward again to capture the next round of investments and the next generation of cellulosic ethanol and cellulosic energy that can be produced both with existing technologies and existing facilities and some of the coming technologies. So we're encouraging you today to work to place Minnesota in a position to capture this investment. The final point that I'd like to bring up here is some of you may know that for 20 years I have worked for conservation and environmental organizations in this state. I have a long interest and a long history of working with the agricultural community and with the conservation community. And there's been a long-standing conflict or tug of war, you might say, between agriculture, production agriculture, and conservation. I believe this bill that you have before you today is an opportunity to bring these two conflicts in society and land use together, and on working agricultural lands produce a very valuable product which will be economically valuable to both the farmer and the rural community nearby, at the same time as protecting our water and providing valuable wildlife habitat. This is an opportunity to achieve a knitting together of those two communities that for so long have been working alongside each other, but with at a certain tension. And I urge you to seize this opportunity and move forward. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Mr. Arnosti? Representative Falks?
Thank you. I have a question for Representative Peterson. On page 2, I'm looking at 2.36, cellulosic biofuel producer payments is calling for 15 cents per gallon if the plant is, if production has begun by June 30th of 2012. On the next page, on 3.17, if the plant is done by 2015, it's 30 cents per gallon. Why is there a difference in that, and can you explain how that works? And then we've actually got the same thing on page 5 with bioenergy production payments being at 0.75 per million, for 1 million BTUs, and on the next page it jumps to 1.5 if, again, the plant starts production a little bit later on. Can you explain why that is, please?
Representative Peterson?
I believe that's the Representative Chair Otemba and Representative Fowles, that's the proposed, I guess, steps to the sizing of the facilities and what you might use in them, if you will. You know, blended cellulosic feedstocks, you know, and then up to the, I guess, native, you know, perennial feedstocks, if you will. It's under evolution, if you will, as to what it will be.
Representative Falls.
Okay, I guess I can accept that for now. My second question then is, one of the things that people have talked about quite a bit with the ethanol payments that we currently have are that there was no formula that cut them off if the price of ethanol went to a certain level. I don't see that in here either. Is there thought of adding that in at some point in time?
Representative,
I believe that's the counter-cyclical, like federal farm payments undergo. I believe that would be something that this the people interested in this bill would be considering. Yeah, it might not be in there today, but I think we're going to go to plenty of committees. A couple of them probably being a couple finance committees. So yeah, I mean when corn ethanol was making money and they still had a lot of producer payments to get, you know, they were ripe for unallotment and then they got unallotted, you know, in 2003. So it's not a value I shared with the governor, but it was out there, and we've seen what happens if it's just dangling out there.
Representative Paul.
The thing I like about it is that you can put a lot more in the bottom end if you take it away in the top end, and it makes it much more palatable to everybody involved, so that's why I like that.
Representative Mr. Faust, appreciate your suggestion as we move forward then.
Any other questions? The next testifier, could you state your name for the committee?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me here today. My name is Tom Kelleher, and I'm a conservation district technician for the Renville County Soil and Water Conservation District in Olivia, Minnesota. I'm on my 28th year with working with conservation in the intensely agricultural part of Minnesota. I manage 381 Reinvest in Minnesota easements. And I also in the feedlot inspector for Renville County, so I get on about 500 to 600 farms a year. And I know the rural landscape exceptionally well, and especially a intensely agricultural landscape. Renville County is number one in corn and number one in sweet peas, number one in sweet corn, number two in soybeans. I don't know what's going on there. We're going to have to fix that. Number three in sugar beets, but we're also the number one county in Reinvest in Minnesota easements with 381 easements and about 15,000 acres. And I said that, and I think that says volumes for what farmers will do. There's people that have stereotypes and opinions on what farmers will or will not do. And quite frankly, farmers respond to government. In the 28 years that I've been in Renville County, I've seen pretty good farm bills and pretty good government come out of both federal and state concerning farmers and farmland, and I've seen some stuff that isn't so good. I've seen farmers react favorably, and I've seen farmers react not so favorably. And so farmers respond to the degree and to the choices that government allows them to respond. And that's why I'm here today, is because of the fact that I'm concerned about the impact that raising more corn may have on Renville County, may have on the state of Minnesota's waters. We all know that I was at the TMDL meeting in Arden Hills a couple of weeks ago, and we all spent several hours there talking about how we're going to clean up Lake Pepin. And quite frankly, we're not going to do it by growing more corn. That's just simply not going to happen. We need to find some way to get more grass on the landscape, and whether it be cellulosic plants or whether it be livestock, somehow we got to diversify our landscape. Fence row to fence row, row crops is basically what's ailing our waters in Minnesota right now. And if we keep doing the same old, we're going to keep getting the same old. And that's why I'm extremely interested in this bill, is because it will allow landowners, and believe me, there's acres on every farm that will lend itself, that farmers can make more money growing grass than they can growing row crops. However, the governments have pretty much forced these guys to continue to grow row crops on those properties, and we all know what happens to properties that probably shouldn't have row crops on. If this would become a possibility, I see it as probably correcting a large portion of the water quality problems that we have in this state, and not be a burden on the farmers. Farmers are good people. They respond basically to what we all ask of them. And we've got the best farmers in the world, and this would just be another tool to make them even better than what they are today. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kelleher, how many corn acres do you anticipate in Renville County to be removed and replaced with grass if this does take effect?
I would guess that there's probably 50 to 60,000 acres that would lend itself better to growing other crops than row crops.
So, just thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I'm clear, about 50,000 corn and soybean acres removed from Renville County?
Removed from Renville County. You know, that would be the possibility, you know, how many acres that would be considered not prime farmland or not prime ag land or lands that would suit themselves better to be either in a pasture type situation or growing grasses for some other reason, like cellulose.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Keller.
Thanks, Doc.
Next is Jim Falk from South County. His own testimony, and for the record, a constituent of mine.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Falk, and I'm on the State Policy Committee with Land Stewardship Project and a board member with CURE, and I'm testifying on their behalf and in conjunction, of course, as they are both members of Clean Energy Minnesota. I'd like to share a little bit about myself and my business. I operate a grain and livestock farm in Swift County with my wife, Karen. I'm the fourth generation to own that land and raise a family from our farm operation. Karen and I also own Falk Seed Farm, an independent seed company that provides seeds for conventional farming systems, organic seed for organic farmers, grass seeds, alfalfas, some lawn seed, and one part of our business that we've tried to specialize in is native seed for prairie restoration and government programs such as the conservation programs of CRP or Minnesota's Reinvest in Minnesota program, the RIM program. Because of our experience with these programs, I believe this bill has the ability to provide economic opportunities for our communities while also providing environmental benefits for our soil and our water. I would like to testify on behalf of two concepts that I feel are extremely important in this bill. The first being community and farmer ownership. Many areas of our state are experiencing a loss in population and are suffering from the economic downturn that we are well aware of as larger and larger farm operations and the consolidation in agribusiness enters our communities. And these trends are not going away anytime soon. We're not changing our trends in agriculture in that sense. So communities must reach out to new opportunities. The ethanol industry today is a success story, and community ownership was at the heart of that industry from day one. So we must prioritize community and farmer ownership if we are truly interested in helping outstate Minnesota. Imagine, if you will, that we could be producing cellulosic ethanol in our own backyard and sending our dollars outstate or out of our country. So I believe it's important to have a significant majority ownership of farmers and community investors, and the proposed language provides these protections. The second concept is the added incentive to establish perennial crops and harvest them for ethanol production. The multiple benefits of encouraging this type of cropping system are numerous, and they've been touched on today, and they certainly are pointed out in the bill. When we look at soil erosion, it's a huge problem, and it has been for many years. Even after years of conservation programs and practices, we still lose a tremendous amount of Minnesota soil through major storm events. Permanent vegetative cover in a perennial cropping system after establishment will keep the soil intact and significantly reduce the likelihood of soil erosion. This is important in that it reduces the potential for harmful chemicals and fertilizers to wash into our water, along with the soil that was eroding. Improved water quality is another benefit, as just indicated with soil erosion, in the sense that perennial crops act like a huge filter system, protecting our waters when we have these major storm events. Another thing I'd just like to mention is energy conversion. It's another thing to consider. If we're in the business of making energy, which this bill is all about, and we are expending as much as we are getting back. We're really not accomplishing very much. So when we look at energy efficiency, we must look at how much energy it takes to actually till the soil and plant a new crop every year in a conventional cropping system. In this perennial cropping system, once it's established, there's certainly significantly less energy expended in that practice. Water usage is another thing that we need to consider, and it could be a very potential benefit when we look at efficiencies. And I don't know that we have all the answers on this, but the first indicators, I think, indicate that we may have reduced water usage in some of these ethanol conversions, these cellulosic ethanol conversions from perennial crops. Energy efficiency is also dependent on high yield in relation to the amount of raw mass used in the process. And once again, perennials in the studies provide some advantages. The buzzword, of course, is global warming, and it would appear that we have a consensus in the scientific community that it exists, and we're accelerating that problem. So we have a chance to have a positive carbon exchange. So regardless of which, looking at what this bill offers for us, in conclusion, I ask you to support our rural communities by protecting this business model of farmer and community ownership by a significant majority, and I ask that you consider the multiple benefits derived from incentivizing a perennial cropping system. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 589.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Representative Peterson, we have about, I suppose, 8 minutes. Do you want to go ahead and continue, or do you want to roll it over for a while afterwards? Or
I think if...
we give everybody 3 minutes.
I guess, considering who's on the list, I would go to Coda Energy
okay. Real
fast for 2 minutes. And then the other two folks on the list are here all the time. And if you're willing to talk to them outside of the committee room as to what their opinion is, I'd like to move it to the committee that Representative Eakin referred to today, if the committee so desires.
Okay. Either that, or we could have it first thing Wednesday morning, too. It's up to you. I guess since
we're having, Madam Chair and the committee, since we're on an aggressive timeline for deadlines, it's been 20 years, the fastest time, if we could get moving, I'd appreciate it, because I think it's going to go to several more committees. But if you want to keep it, it's your committee. You can decide.
Okay, thank you. Well,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Kramer from Coda Energy. Coda Energy is a combined heat and power plant that will be fueled by 100% agricultural-based products, and it will be built in Shakopee, Minnesota. It's a partnership between Rahm Alpern Company, a family-owned company that's been in business since 1847. It's our 160th year. And the Shakopee, Mindawak, and Sioux community, a little bit older family. Rahm Alpern is the largest malt production facility in the world, actually, and converts 20 million bushels of barley into malt for food use and beverage use. A big barley producer. Coda Energy Project was born out of the desire to stay in business as a malting company in Shakopee, Minnesota. And to do so, energy costs had to be controlled and controlled in an environmentally responsible and sustainable manner. Rahm Alpern Company and our partners, the Shakopee, Mindawak, and Sioux, saw an opportunity to fulfill a desire to produce clean, sustainable, renewable energy through this partnership by using agricultural byproducts from the malting operation and other agricultural products located within a 50-mile radius of our facility in Shakopee, Minnesota. There's plenty of fuel to power this plant. We'll produce 16.5 megawatts of renewable baseload energy. That's enough electricity to produce for 16,000 homes. It'll also provide heat to our malting company that will totally eliminate its use of natural gas. Coda needs 175,000 tons a year of agricultural type products. And this plant is currently in the permitting process at the MPCA. We plan to begin construction as soon as we get the air permit and be operational by spring of 2008. Our location near the Minnesota River is an ideal area for energy crops to be grown because we all know how sensitive the Minnesota River is. Again, this bioenergy is the Field of Dreams, and I think this bill promotes the development of a biofuel infrastructure system. Without this system, the future implementation of new bioenergy technologies such as cellulosic ethanol will be difficult because there isn't going to be the agri-production and delivery system in place. That's what this bill does. Again, I think Code Energy is an important project. It's a $55 million investment in Minnesota. It'll have an annual payroll of over $750,000 a year, and we'll pay $6 million a year to local agricultural producers for our fuel. So instead of buying natural gas from Texas or from Alberta, Canada, we're going to buy it from the people that live right next to us. We'll protect some jobs at Shakopee and create support for a new biofuel. So I urge you to support this bill. It's good for business, it's good for Code Energy, and I think it's good for the cellulosic approach to energy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Are there any questions, comments? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one real quick one. Representative Peterson, the total cost of the bill, could you tell us what it is, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, that's a great question. There's not been a fiscal response. Mr. Arnosti can help. Come on up here and help. But, you know.
Okay.
To the extent I know the exact amount, we've got a proposed amount. So, thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Don Arnosti. At this point in time, we're proposing $20 million in bonding for the RIM clean energy easements. We're proposing $13.25 million in general fund dollars that are spread in many different ways, as you can see in the bill, only a half million of which would be recurring on an annual basis. So most of it's one-time money having to do with R&D, having to do with technical assistance, having to do with bringing the Pollution Control Agency up to speed, having to do with giving funds to Bowser to roll out the easements. They need staff and personnel to do the easements one time. And then beyond that, there are the producer payments, which are capped at $27 million a year in one category and $11 million a year in another. Those are intended to capture, for the most part, the producer payments that presently are going to the corn ethanol industry as they come offline. So those will ramp up over time. We would not expect those payments for the most part. Most of those would not begin immediately. Some of them would. And so it's a little bit difficult to say exactly what the payment might be in 08 or 09, but that's what's in the bill.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, I applaud your efforts to reduce our dependency on foreign oil and keep us a leader in renewables. We heard testimony here today about this bill removing up to 50,000 corn acres out of Renville County alone. What do you see as far as the total number of corn and soybean acres being removed out of Minnesota if this bill passes?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, yet to be determined, because that was an estimate out of one county, which I believe I'm not going to guess as to how much, but I would add for the record, I think there's room for this type of development on Minnesota ag lands. As each generation, there seems to be fewer and fewer people in rural Minnesota. I think adding this as a tool to the ag economy is a good way to go. And if corn and soybeans have something to compete against, I don't see that as a bad option for rural counties. And if it pays at a rate that's equivalent to the USDA loan rate on corn or soybeans or the per acre profit, if you will, you know, is it profit? Is it dollars per bushel or is it dollars per acre? I would think that this is a viable option if it's implemented and structured correctly in the state, and we get a head start on some other states. But you know, I see that there's room in rural Minnesota for a third crop, if you will. I don't know the total number of acres, but you know, that would be just my value statement on why it's needed.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't know if the Minnesota Department of Agriculture could comment on that either. You know, I'm worried about livestock production also, you know, seeking a balance to make sure that we don't take all the corn and soybeans or put so much pressure to where we do not have an affordable feed source anymore for our livestock producers. You know, that was one of the questions and concerns about ethanol. And Representative Peterson, like I said, I do respect reducing our, you know, your intentions here. Absolutely, I respect your intentions. And I just want to make sure that our livestock producers compete also. And, you know, having a third crop is fine. One of the concerns about having these producer payments, you know, livestock producers are calling me too, saying, look, we'll compete, you know, as long as it's on a level playing field. Once you start putting government subsidies and everything, and it's putting that added pressure on our feed sources, you know, then no longer are we on a level playing field. So I just want to be aware of the needs out there for livestock producers.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, I believe that grass is a livestock feed too, depending on how you want to produce your livestock. That's been a subject of debate for many, many years at the Capitol as to how we do or do not do livestock in the state of Minnesota. And I believe that with consultation from Mr. Arnosti, I think there's funding for about 10,000 acres in this bill across the state. So, thank you.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, I didn't have this idea, but Representative Szymanski thought maybe we could incorporate more buffalo across the native prairie again, too, and then we'd take care of the livestock. So, anyway, I digress. Members and Representative Peterson, I thank you for the bill. I think we need to start considering all ideas and all ways to go on this. Obviously, this will... Madam Chair, there's so much in here that we could spend 2 weeks of sessions surgically going through here and talking about every single page. I've highlighted and put question marks by many, many sections in here, and I think you agree with that. This is a pretty this is not an easy bill to follow, and certainly there's all sorts of things in here that are going to take a lot of policy discussion. So I guess, Representative Peterson, I mean, on that note, as you start sending it through, you say you're on an aggressive path. I understand that. But if you know, is it your intent that do you believe this will become law in this way, shape, and form, or are you putting an idea out there for the future? I guess is a question, because certainly there's a lot to do on this bill. Obviously, we backed down in my committee at some point for finance, but certainly finance and policy are pretty interrelated, so there'll be some discussions there too. Representative Hilty, members, for example, this morning said he's got 40 bills in his committee right now on renewable energy, 20 of them asking for money. So this is not the only bill out there either. And I guess I'm just trying to get some direction from you and this committee, which is the Ag Policy Committee, and there's all sorts of ag policy in here that hasn't even been brought up, and I could ask a lot of questions, but I'm not going to at this point in time. Just trying to get a feel from you on direction of this bill.
Chair Tremont, Representative Junkie, I think that since you're the chair of the Ag Finance Committee, you'll have a lot of input as to what is or isn't in it, and I'm hoping that we can get to your committee with your input prior to a hearing as to what you would like to see or not see come out of your committee, thinking and assuming that you have your own ideas as to the way this should go. Since it's going to several committees in theory, and you can decide what you want to do here today, I do believe, you know, there is this desire to be out there, at least from the letter that was signed to Colin Peterson, to maximize our potential as a state for federal farm bill dollars. As to what gets rolled into a larger package or what pieces do or do not get included, I'm hoping that a lot of that can be worked out with those who desire to be involved, maybe outside of committee. And I know that the Chair Hilty is carrying what's referred to as the governor's package. And that could be a vehicle later, or it could be come in 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 vehicles, depending on how much time we have. But I believe it's a start. I mean, we're already on the delete everything to amendment before the first committee. And so I see what you're saying about lots of things to work out and work through, and there's lots of department folks in residence to tell us what they would like if we had more time today. But I anticipate that your committee will be definitely intent on marking parts of this up. Okay. Not to ignore the chair and Tremba's intent here either.
One quick question, Representative Hempstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to vote on this today?
Yes.
Well, I have a ton of questions to piggyback off what Representative Junkie said. There's so much in here. The DE2 was dated today at 11:45 a.m., so you know, we didn't have too much time to get into it. I have highlighted many, many different areas that do talk about ag policy, like Representative Junkie said, not only the financial side of how we subsidize not only the plants but the farmers, but then also the management plans and the way that we're going to dictate to how those crops are farmed, when they can be harvested, for instance. We can't harvest during the bird nesting season. So we're essentially going to come in then, the government's going to come in and say, this is how, you know, this is the management plan, this is how you're going to farm this. I think that's a big shift in ag policy, and for us to send this out without maybe some more debate and maybe some more time to work on it. I applaud you for your efforts. You've thrown out, I think, the first plan for subsidized, I shouldn't even say subsidized, but sort of the corn ethanol plan for cellulosic ethanol. And I think that needed to be thrown out there. Now we can start the debate, but for us to send it out, I think, is premature. So I would urge you to reconsider having to take a vote. Otherwise, members, I want to call for a roll call, and I would suggest a no vote.
Well, Representative Finstead, I know this is a work in progress, and I know it needs to go to other committees. And maybe we can send them to another committee and then ask for it back after we've had time to look at it individually or together, if that would be an option.
Madam Chair, you know, I might go through a lot of committees. I don't doubt that, but, you know, I don't have the luxury of sitting on some of them. So, if you know, I won't ask for a roll call, I guess, if people don't want to put the name on it quite yet, if we get your commitment that it will come back to this committee once again.
Well, Representative Finstead, that would be, along with Representative Peterson, that we would do that.
Okay.
I just wanted to keep moving, and we've got things on our agendas for a little while, and then we can have it come back, and then we can look at what the bill actually looks like at that point. So we can kind of clean it up as a policy committee rather than just cleaning it up now and then having it change. So if you would like to renew your motion.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 589 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Bioscience and Emerging Technology Committee.
And I will add as amended. So all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion passed. We thank you very much. We have to refer two bills to the Veterans Affairs. One from Representative Haas, House File 300, Rukavina, House File 390. And our next meeting is Wednesday, February 21st at 8 a.m. Committee adjourned.